We want to examine today something that we kind of touch on the periphery on a lot of shows, and it'll be a good opportunity to just kind of focus in on it. And that's looking at not just, you know, fleet numbers or a specific ship or a specific program, but in a broader sense, do we have the right balance in our fleet? Like any toolbox, if all you have are socket wrenches, if all you have is hammers, it kind of limits what you can do and what you can create and what you can try to affect down the road. But we want to talk about, do we have that right fleet balance? Specifically looking at expeditionary forces, or depending upon what generation you were, you might refer to them as expeditionary forces. But we'll look at what capabilities we have might be the most cost effective, what give the combatant commanders the most options and the most utility for the sailors and Marines they happen to have in their AOR. We also want to look at what are some either programmatic, political, just thematic or inertia that's driving the structure of our fleet. And our guest for the full hour will be Lieutenant Colonel James W. Hammond III, United States Marine Corps retired. He is now a senior manager over at WBB. And before he decided to put on the suit and tie with those ladies and gentlemen, he was director of the Commandant's Staff Group. Wes, welcome to MidRats.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Hey, I really appreciate you coming on this Sunday. And just as a scene setter here, what if you take a moment to explain to from your perspective to our listeners, when you look at how our fleet is structured right now, what is out of balance? What's driving that imbalance? And what direction or trends do we see in the fleet's balance going forward?
Well, I guess probably to start off, you know, the title, A Fleet Out of Balance, was not what I picked as a title originally. And like most publications, I grew up, my father was an editor for the Gazette and then later for the Naval Academy Alumni Magazine, so I'm fully aware that the editor has full rights of what he wants to put for a title. My original title was on amphibious reluctancy, which is what I was more focused on. But it did lead into the problem of fleet balance, and I wasn't trying to solve the problem of what the fleet, you know, how completely where the balance point was. I was just focused on the fact that the amphibious portion I felt was not properly accounted for in the organization, and I think that the things that drive that are there's a whole lot of factors, I would say, because this has sort of come through a number of years of putting this idea together. Part of it is kind of the tribalization or the, you know, sectors, the communities within the Navy just keep, you know, getting further and further apart, in my mind, at least, from what I've seen. And I think the Marine Corps' representation in that sometimes and the amphibious forces is not well accounted for. And part of it is because, if you notice in there, I use Wiley as a quote. And there was a reason I like Wiley for a whole lot of reasons. One, because he's a naval officer. Two, because he has some credibility, especially within the strategic community, I think, these days. And I think it's easier to account for, quantify other strike type operations as opposed to something that's a little less hard numbers, like what do you get from going ashore and creating more durable control, as Wiley would say. Does that kind of explain how I got there?
Works for me. Eagle One.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a back to basics kind of guy, so let's talk a little bit about what you're talking about when you talk about the amphibious force and why that's important.
I think it's more than just amphibious ships. We have, you know, if you look at what an amphibious force was, if you look at the task organizations and groupings that you did in previous, you know, even up to Vietnam and stuff, it wasn't just the amphibious ships that you thought of as part of the amphibious force. It was forming the task groups and task units that provided you all the capabilities you needed to do to gain access to create the forcible entry force. And I think more now we think about it just as amphibious ships. There was a part of that article, because it was originally a lot longer, that went into a little bit more detail into naval gunfire, mine countermeasures, those type of things also.
One of the things that I've always found intriguing about it, and I kind of alluded to it in the opening, is the lexicon, the words that we use to describe what is really a set of assets that give the capability to the combatant commander. And depending upon, you know, which episode of Proceedings, and I don't think I actually mentioned you, I appreciate you mentioning the fact that, you know, one of the things that we're using as a touchstone for today's show, if people have a copy of their February Proceedings, Wes's article was titled The Fleet Out of Balance, on page 38 if you're looking for it. But that's kind of what we're using as a touchstone. But let's go back to words again, because depending upon which episode of Proceedings you picked up from what year, you would see the same set of assets described either as amphibious, maybe expeditionary, marine, and depending upon the flavor of the month to a certain extent, the utility and the capabilities have remained roughly the same. But is part of the challenge of explaining what these assets bring to the fight, for lack of phrase, is that battle of trying to explain outside the Navy Marine Corps team of what this group of ships and capabilities bring to the fight. Are we using the right lexicon? If so, which part of that lexicon may work best to explain the capabilities outside the family? And if not, maybe what are some better descriptions that we can use for this capability?
I think all of it, you know, I don't think you can just use one or the other. I think all of them kind of convey their own meanings, and I think that's important. You know, expeditionary in the historical term usually has meant operations that are overseas. Amphibious implies that it goes from the ocean or from the seas to land. Littoral means that it operates in what we, you know, how defining the littoral is, both on the seaward side and the landward side. All of those have their own subtle meanings, and they all apply to the problem set that you have to deal with in that area.
There you go. I told you, I warned you, I might not be able to find my mute button. When we're looking at the power projection, I mean, your argument is, I gather, to a certain extent, the size of the amphibious force has declined relative to the size of the total naval force, and that's in the number of hulls. You're not talking in capacity, are you?
Yes, I do talk in capacity also. I mean, one of the arguments I make in my article is, while all of the fleet has to, and I go back and I use 1989 as a point of departure for a comparison, and we can discuss why if you want to, but I mean, I use that as a point because, you know, at that point, the Cold War ended, the strategic environment changed somewhat. Also, our strategic posture significantly changed. You know, we went from, and we started a path that we're almost at the end of, where we were forward, the U.S. was forward garrisoned forces in key areas, to once again going back to what I think, you know, Bob Work calls an expeditionary air, where we really have to project from the United States our combat power. That's where our power projection comes from almost immediately. Instead of just supporting it with naval forces, as we tended to do for the most part during the Cold War, now that naval force becomes a critical enabler, you know, to set the criteria for whatever operation we're in. If you look at it, the numbers, yes, everybody went down, but the capabilities for strike, because of changes in technology, the ship, you know, how ships were built, what they're able to do, your ability to strike with missiles and aircraft has actually increased over the lesser platforms you have today compared to what you had 23 years ago. At the same time, amphibs went down probably the most in numbers, and the numbers aren't really that important because, you know, the size of the ships also increased. So you can make that case. Where you lost about 50% of your ships, your tonnage is down about 30%. But what's also down significantly is the capacity of those ships to carry forces forward, both measured both in troops, square footage, and to a little, somewhat of an extent, cubic foot of cargo.
Over in the chat room, BJ Armstrong proposed a question that folded into something that I've been pondering quite a bit recently. And I think it hits on a theme, so I'm going to steal this question and bring it. And what I've been thinking about a lot recently is, after every major conflict, and we've been at this for a decade, institutions and leaders can develop new habits, think they've learned something new that might be a little more specific to a certain conflict but has limited larger items, or there could be something learned in a new conflict that's kind of a game changer on how a national command authority or the military structure responds to crises. And what BJ puts up there is, with special operations forces really developing almost the underlying theme of taking their capabilities global, and as special operations forces are quickly becoming the go-to crisis responders today for our senior leadership on the civilian side, does that lend itself to either a understandable decline in relying on the Marine Corps and amphibious force capability, or is that complementary in a way? How do you see that changing from, as opposed to having the Marines be the 911 force, to getting on the phone to SOCOM instead?
Well, I think it's complementary more so than anything. I mean, obviously they bring certain skill sets, and they've, you know, the last 10 years those skill sets have been greatly increased. But I think you're still going to run into a problem of what they're focused on, and their capacity is still, you know, you're never going to have enough of those forces. I mean, that's general for everybody, but I think specifically for highly trained forces that need to focus on a specific mission for a certain period of time and then have a certain reset time after that, which is what's been demonstrated the last 10 years, you know, they're great for many things. There's no getting around that, but I think let's not think they can solve all the world's problems here either. And if I think if you look in that article, my article a little bit more, you notice one of the things you bring out is a number of commitments over the last 20 years or so that Marines have been involved in compared to what they were in the Cold War. Actually, I use the word amphibious forces in that because I think they bring a lot more versatility and capacity for a whole range of operations.
Yeah, you indicated that the amphibious forces had been employed about 116 times since the end of the Cold War, and I gather you include in that things like Haiti and the tsunami and other episodes. Do you envision ever the U.S. Marine Corps and the amphibious forces ever having to do forced landings again, a la, you know, Tarawa and Guam and those places?
Well, I mean, I'm always hesitant to give the we'll never do something argument, because twice in my life I've been burned by that piece. I mean, and I'll give you the classic example of that was, right before I was the director of the Commandant Staff Group, I was a member of the Strategic Initiatives Group at Headquarters of Marine Corps. And it was right after the 2001 QDR had just been done. So this beautiful Tuesday morning, we were sitting in a conference room on the A-ring having a discussion that the Commandant wanted us to look at, which was the future niche of the Marine Corps. And we'd been drinking coffee and arguing for about 2 hours, and finally, about 9:15 that day, someone, you know, talked about, you know, we were in this whole thing about whether it's just littoral forcible entry or whether it was deeper forcible entry, and someone put their hand, you know, right on a map and said, "We will never go here," and I can still see their thumb on Afghanistan. Well, we took a break because we'd been drinking coffee, and we go out and we find that, you know, the first two planes have hit it in New York, and, you know, 20 minutes later, you know, we're in the new wedge, so it was, you know, right next to where the plane hit. And, you know, I remember thinking back about that a day or two later going, my God, the, you know, the guy that said that, he had no idea we were on our way there at the time. So I guess I'm very leery of making broad absolutes like that. I would say Tarawa, for one thing, was a learning lesson, and you get into this whole issue of discussing, you know, whether it's best to attack, you know, into the teeth for an amphibious assault, or it's better to do, you know, more of an envelopment and go where the enemy's not. I've always argued that the Marine Corps always recognized the fact that you would want to go where the enemy's not if you can. Operationally, you did that in the Central Pacific because you decided which islands you were going to go to. You just were stuck with certain islands that you needed, and you had to go into the teeth, and there was no other option because of how small they were. So I think we're always going to try to avoid going into the teeth of the fight, but I don't, our teeth of the enemy. But, and there's many ways I think we technologically we can do that now. But I wouldn't give an absolute.
I'm always a big fan of when you're really trying to investigate whether you're heading in the right direction, what you're doing, is to benchmark what other people are doing globally. If you could take for a minute and talk about what other nations have done in the last quarter century with regard to their amphibious capabilities.
You know, it's interesting, and I started looking this maybe 10 years ago when I saw that the Royal Navy was basically rebuilding their amphibious force, not right after the Falklands, but a good 10 years or so after, or 10, 15 years afterwards. You know, they had some very old amphibs at the beginning of 2000 or so. And in the, you know, in 6 or 7 years, they not only rebuilt their fleet, but almost doubled the tonnage, the square footage that they could provide in that period. And then when we, you know, since then, I've looked at it in other places, and I think I talk a little bit about it in the article. But if you look at other people's amphibious forces, matter of fact, I think I had it in the, it was taken out. If you look at like 9 countries, you know, the United Kingdom, France, Netherlands, Spain, Italy, Austria, Japan, North Korea, or South Korea, and India, all of them have considerably, in the last 10, 15 years or so, built very modern amphibious ships. They've increased their tonnage. I mean, you've gone from a lot of LSTs or LST-like smaller ships to a lot more number of first LPDs. The Rotterdam was sort of the initial cut on that. And then now you're seeing a lot more LHD-type ships being built. So the numbers increase, you know, almost
80
or so.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. But if you look at tonnage... And I would also, you know, argue that it's not just tonnage, it's an out-of-area capacity, too, that they weren't ever looking at before. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. They, if you look at what they're saying as they're building these, there's a lot of discussion within their governments, within their military, about the versatility of these ships, and that word is used quite a bit, I think, for amphibious forces globally a lot. And what they mean by that a lot of times is what they can do both at the lower end as well as being able to contribute or provide contribution for their nation in a crisis at the higher ends. So lower end, they bring a lot about the humanitarian capabilities these ships bring, logistics, a whole number of operations, as well as provide a capability to provide forces for a major operation that they can contribute as part of a partnership, allyship, whatever.
Yeah, you anticipated my next question pretty well, which was the talk a little bit about the versatility of the amphibs that you've done in your article. And I guess one of my concerns is that in your article you mentioned that in addition to the decrease in the number of hulls for amphibs, there's also been a decline in the necessary helpers for amphibious operations, the minesweeps and stuff like that. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think if you look at minesweepers, just straight mine countermeasure ships, I think you see a decrease of you know, we've gone from 24 to 14. Now, of course, from 1989 to 2000, which is about a 42% decrease. Now, of course, LCS will have that capability to a degree once hopefully it becomes proven. Mine countermeasures, I think, is a little bit harder to just, in fairness, to just attribute to certain numbers of ships, since I think you bring a lot of capabilities with multi-mission ships that have bring a part of that, as well as, especially now, more and more coming from helicopters and other aircraft, as well as the ability to put out remote control or underwater, I'm not going to use the word drones, but, you know, UUVs that add a lot of capability. So, but I think a lot of it's still unproven, and I'm a little concerned about where we stand with that. The other enabler I think I talk a lot about is naval gunfire, or naval surface fire. I think we have just seen a complete drop in that over the years. And it's not just the gun systems. It's the size of the gun systems. We see no increase in real range. We'll see a little bit increase in range finally when we do get DDG 1000, but you know that's going to be six guns total. If you look at the size of those guns and what they're able to do, you know, we've seen a dramatic decrease in what I term use a term called throw weight, which is simply the size of the magazines, the number of rounds, the number of tubes, and then the weight of those things, and you multiply that across the fleet, and it gives you an idea of what you have for capacity. And I think there's other pieces of it too that we, you know, the other piece about naval surface fires, I think, is not just guns, but also the target acquisition capabilities, other technologies and pieces of the pie have not been addressed either.
Part of that, as always, and boy, I could spend all day talking about naval surface fires, because I agree with you as well. I've always thought it was a shame we never went with the Mark 71 8-inch 20 years ago. I'd still love for somebody to take that out. But anyway, different planet. But you mentioned something earlier about the tribalism we have amongst our services, and there can be good tribalism and bad tribalism. And I think what we're going to be seeing more and more, a little sharper edge than we've always seen. There's always been a battle over resources and funding during the fat years or the thin years, but the thinning years, it always gets a little heavier and a little sharper. And I think we saw the first elbows being thrown by the Marine Corps during the Haiti operations, because one thing that you mentioned earlier is there is a flexibility and a utility that you have, in the lack of a better phrase, these amphibious ships that you really don't see in a lot of platforms. Haiti was a good example. And the Marines came out and talked about that and the critical requirements. Even if you're not doing, you know, one of the forcible entry missions, there are other capabilities that come from training for that to do something as basic as we're going into a quasi-non-permissive environment simply because there is no infrastructure to bring anything ashore. How do you bring something ashore without infrastructure? It kind of answers its own question. If the Marine Corps, and we'll just use the Haiti, the dropping off point, I think is doing the best to tell its story. In order to have some type of tribalism, you have to have another tribe on the other end. Historically, that has been the Army. Which of the other services has the most valid argument against the need to expend diminishing resources on amphibious capabilities? Has another service come up with a good argument that could lend some people to perhaps change their position, or if they were neutral, to lean to the way to take limited assets and to allocate it to other platforms and other capabilities besides amphibious lift?
Well, I guess the short answer is I can't think of one. I think it gets into kind of one of the hearts of the article that I discuss is this idea of standoff strike, of a strike capability being a focus for you know, as an answer for why we don't need to put forces ashore. And if you notice, the thrust of that article, piece on that, I discussed 2 points. One brought up by Wiley, Rear Admiral J.C. Wiley, back in the 60s, where he talks about the idea that, you know, sometimes, you know, destruction, as he calls it, you know, what he discusses is the idea of what is the purpose of war. War is to achieve some level of control. Destruction does not equal control. It may contribute to it, may contribute to it significantly, but sometimes it's many times not sufficient. Therefore, you have to introduce forces ashore that provide that capability. I think the Marine Corps' niche is really mostly in being able to achieve that level of access early on. That's why readiness, I think, is important, and being that 911 force is being able to react and provide that access when it is needed. It provides a force that is able to focus at this complex problem between air or, you know, land and sea. But I think the other piece in that I talk about was Captain Hughes's argument that, you know, that where he kind of takes the Navy stand, or many in the Navy stand, to task on the idea that precision standoff, precision strike approach is twice in air, I think is the term he uses. He points out the fact to believe in its sufficiency is to believe in the idea that it could achieve almost always when you want it to the results you're finding. And I think that's what we saw, especially early on, the beginning of OIF-1, the shock and awe idea that suddenly we were going to, you know, create this capacity for the Iraqis or Saddam in particular to fold automatically because, you know, we had this massive strike and it didn't pan out.
Yeah, I'm always reminded especially when I was reading what you wrote about T.R. Fehrenbach's quote in his book about the Korean War, this kind of war, that you may fly over land forever, you may bomb it, atomize it, pulverize it, and so forth, but if you desire to defend it, protect it, and keep it, you must do it on the ground. And I gather that to a certain extent, that's what you're pointing out, that surgical strike sounds good in concept, not necessarily great in execution, because it's limiting. There's only a certain amount of damage you can do.
Now, you know, I'm an artilleryman by background, and believe you me, I mean, I believe in using, you know, whatever limit of strike can do. But what I also understand is, and this I think where you kind of get into the tribalism of not understanding the idea of what it limits an understanding across the force is understanding the idea of combined arms, the idea that fires and maneuver or other types of functions and you know, warfighting functions, when they're put together in various proportions, can provide you some very difficult – well, first of all, it creates dilemmas for the enemy, and that's what you really want to do, because I think that is – the essence of how we try to fight, especially with combined arms. And I think that's, you know, it's not just fires are bad. It's fires together need to be understood with other types of operations, including maneuver.
Just like the enemy gets a vote, the enemy gets to shoot back too. And I think one of the interesting arguments that we've seen is getting the right capability to move our amphibious ships further from shore with the anti-access area denial weapons that, yeah, they've always been here, just new ones are coming online and we got to adjust to it. But I think part of what's driving that also is trying to find a balance between the economies of scale of having larger ships, but when you have fewer numbers of larger ships, the significant risk that you have with the loss of one of those ships during an operation gets very, very, very prohibitive and can almost be warping on your other planning aspects. Have we found a good balance between the economies of scales of having larger ships while also being able to continue an operation with the loss of one or more of them? Or is that something that perhaps is warping our decision making in the larger aspect?
I've been looking at GRAM, which GRAM being guided rockets, artillery, mortars, and missiles for some studies we've been doing at work. And most people focus on that as being part of the AD portion of A2AD, though I would always argue that there is no real fine line between A2 and AD. Repeatedly I saw this as, you know, our acquisition system optimizes to provide highly, very capable platforms that, because they're capable, are more expensive. We end up having fewer numbers of and bigger ones, because that's how we get very capable things in many respects. And it really, I think, you know, it's not just ships. It's other things, I think, when you look at it from the A2AD perspective, is we end up with very small numbers of very capable things, which doesn't play well into our problem, our operational problem set of A2AD.
Eagle One?
Where should we be going? What direction should we be headed in your view, sir?
You know, I didn't put a lot of recommendations at the end. I just think, let me say this. I do think we need to start thinking about, it's not just having more amphibious ships the way we currently look at amphibious ships. We need to look at, how do we put Marines on other platforms across the fleet? I was years ago a MARDET CO, and there was a lot of reasons I thought having Marines out across the fleet, not just on amphibious ships, was good for a lot of cultural reasons within the Naval Service. But I think more than that, there is some tactical and operational things we can do. I think we also need to think about how we provide not just amphibious capability for the engagement portion of what we do, but if we want to do things larger and more, have a crisis ready force, how can we create that? You know, I recently was looking at a study we were looking at for the Incheon landing. And one issue I think most people don't understand about Incheon is, and there's a lot of good examples of Incheon. Of course, it's, over 60 years ago. But Incheon also, the amphibious force there wasn't just U.S. ships that came over or were pulled out of mothballs or however. I mean, most of the amphibious LSTs for the landing at Incheon itself actually were what they call Shipping Control Agency Japan ships that we loaned to the Japanese after World War II for a whole lot of reasons. One, to resupply, so they could supply themselves, and two, bring back all their forces from overseas. But these were ships, I think like 30 of some of the LSTs at Incheon were manned by Japanese sailors and officers. So you have former, Japanese cruiser captains, that really were part of our force. So I'm not saying that's an example, but how do we get some forward reserve capacity that will be there in time and can provide you that same level of forcible entry capability? We need to think about, perhaps means for doing something like that.
We talked earlier in the hour about the 48% increase in the capability in the UK, France, Netherlands, Spain, Italy, Australia, Japan, and even South Korea. Speaking of Korea, when you look at those designs, are there anything that you see in those ships that make you pause and go, "That's a good idea. Maybe that's something that we should look at closer," from either a way it was built, the way they plan to employ it, or something else that other shipyards and nations are doing with their ships that maybe we're not?
Well, I think you're seeing some things that are obviously in some of those shipyards are a lot cheaper. Now, why they're cheaper, I would like to go into more detail and understand why, what trade-offs they've made. Now, a lot of them are made more to commercial standards than we're used to or willing to accept. but I'd like to see what the trade-offs are and what causes some of those, you know, where our expenses are. Someone was telling me the other day that, you know, we have things that we've insisted on being as part of ships that maybe if we had more knowledge, and this isn't just within the Navy, I think of Marines, there is a tendency for Marines not to get involved with understanding shipbuilding problems, where we could provide, you know, leadership could provide better understanding of what they really need and not just accept, you know, the specialist's answer. But the other thing I think to look at is not only the standard ships are built to, but what survivability equipment is on it, whether there's some level of that that you could have on standby to be improved at a certain time, and you wouldn't necessarily need to have it always out there and being used and worn out. There's a number of things I think we can start thinking about for this problem.
Well, somebody seems to be thinking about it. We've got this new USNS semi-submersible connector vessel that seems to be designed to fill some mission. Can you kind of go into where you see that fitting into an amphibious operation?
I'm not sure. Are you talking about a joint high-speed vessel?
No, there's this new it's a semi-submersible. It just basically a deck. It goes out and kind of can submerge itself up to a point, and then cargo can be loaded on it and vehicles and stuff, and they can be put onto LCACs and sent to shore that way without, it's to allow more input.
The MLP? I think it's the MLP, which carries three. Yes, I think there's some. I think that's one means of doing this, but that ship itself only carries a limited amount of equipment. We still haven't figured out how to get the troops there with it effectively. There are some ideas out there. They need to be tested and brought forward. Things like MV-22, the Osprey, might be able to provide a linkage to get troops to connect with that equipment out there. But I think it's only one or two ships, I forget which, within an MPF force. And we're still, I think, working how to get other equipment off of other elements of the MPF to bring it together. But I think you still have a problem of how much capacity you need to create the environment where that, you know, the MPF force in itself is somewhat of a, what's the term Bob Work uses, sensitive access requirement. Yeah, that's the term he uses, where you need something that's less, more of an insensitive access power projection means. And I think that's what the amphibious force brings. And so I think that's where you get into the argument of how many brigades of capacity does the Marine Corps or does the nation need to have in order to then bring in follow-on forces. And I think two point oh is a little bit small. I think you need to have a little bit more than that, 2.5 maybe.
We were talking about some of the big gray holes, but let's talk for a minute about the stuff that goes on them and in them that actually will take Marines to shore. You look at the replacement for the AAV, self-imploded after almost a career's length of development. We'll see what the next plan is for that. But, of course, MV-22 is maturing. The F-35, it is what it is. The CH-53K. Which of those programs seem to be answering the mail, so to speak, and do any of these programs concern you, either there are dangers of being canceled or a danger of simply not being able to show up and do the job as advertised?
I am concerned that we are creating another imbalance within our connector capability. There's a tendency, because of cost especially, to really try to focus on the expensive part of that, which is the airlift capacity. And my concern is what we really need to have is a balanced force there. You know, when you take someone deep inland that is very light, you can create something that's completely unexpected for the opposing force. But they're going to realize it after a certain while. And now that force becomes very dependent on that logistics tail that is air dependent, as well as has limited mobility in itself. You have greater capacity of combat power coming over surface that we need to make sure that we maintain so that they can both work together. And I am concerned that we're losing focus on having those complementary balanced capabilities that can provide both power as well as speed and uncertainty in the eyes of the enemy that can work together.
Well, in some cases, it seems that our capability and some of this amphibious stuff, which seems to be the further offshore stuff, not the littoral and not the or little and the you know, not over the beach stuff, but the AFSBs and the MLPs seem to be, you know, outside of, they're going to be outside of missile range, over the horizon type stuff, and mostly manned, it seems, by merchant mariners. Is that what you've seen?
Well, I think yes, but I also think in many respects we're envisioning using those because of those, you know, civilian mariners and the survivability of those ships in very much more benign or benign situations or situations that have become more, you know, more benign and not as much a risk as being put into it. So I think, yes, you know, something that's more survivable that can go into harm's way a little bit more, like an amphib, is still needed.
Going from the theoretical and the argumentative to a certain extent, we have seen some actual demand signals out there that you would think would lead to a little more of an aggressive discussion about what we're buying and are we using what we're buying very well. We've seen a couple of ESGs that have come back from 8-month to 11-month deployments. And much of the news generally had to do with, wow, they were out there for a long time and came back. What are some of the things that caused them to be out for 8 months and 11 months that perhaps should be a little more part of the narrative in order to describe why they have to be out there that long and what they are doing for our National Command Authority?
I'm not sure I know exactly why. My gut feeling is because we're still feeding forces to, combat operations first in Iraq and now exclusively in Iraq and Afghanistan before and now just Afghanistan. So I think that probably is part of the reason, there might have been a delay. I'm not sure of anything else. What exactly? There probably is more to it. I have no doubt, but I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. Well, part of my take is again, it goes back to the terminology issue. I was just put on a report by DJ, who said they're not ESGs. They're ARGs again. Whatever. Expedition Amphibious Marine, whatever you want to call them, they're out there. But and some have described they're almost light carrier groups in this respect, is that they do a lot more than wait and stand by to do an opposable entry. They do a lot more than just standing by to go, you know, deliver MREs to starving people on the shoreline. That there is a story there. There is a tool set there, which is why their regular deployments are being extended a lot, even though our wars have been mostly land recently. And it also is a concern of mine that story, besides just the number of 8 or 11, is not coming out that much. Am I missing something, or is there an opportunity being missed here if you want to shape a discussion towards a need to have these ships be a higher percentage of the fleet and the capability it brings?
I think there's arguments being made, but I don't think it's necessarily being heard. If you go back to the Haiti issue, of course, Haiti is not a stretch because it's not very far to go. Obviously, the reach issue is not big. But even in that case, and you alluded to it, was the idea that when you used, if you compare it to bringing things by C-17s versus bringing things by amphibious ships and then MPF ships that came quickly afterwards, what you had was you had very little impact on the infrastructure. For a humanitarian disaster type operation, that became critical, where, you know, planes coming from the CONUS, you know, you had to put the airfield back together, you had to find places to park planes, you had to find places to unload that were in that particular area that might have had problems in itself. You had to cordon off from, you know, civilians coming onto those areas that were, you know, starving or hungry or needed water or whatever. And I think the amphibious ships, as you probably, you know, you alluded to, could do a lot of things. Plus, you know, everybody that worked there, if you needed to keep them messed and berthed and as much as possible on the ship, the sea base became a very beneficial for reducing the problem ashore and not, you know, adding to it. I think the same thing happens as you get more and more into combat operations. It gives the National Command Authority the ability to, you know, rheostat or turn up and down the amount of commitment that we're requiring. Does that sort of where you were headed on that?
That'll work.
Okay.
Well, I want to thank you for the this is not a premature end of the show, but,
okay.
But you know, I really hadn't connected all the dots internally. I, as an old destroyer guy and who spent some time in the service force, I really didn't have much to do with the amphibs, and I wasn't really until I read your article, I really wasn't connecting the dots with how important it was to have the supporting players around the amphibs and what that means. And one of the comments in the chat room is talking about the difference between the ARG and the ESGs, and you know, mostly that difference is that the protection from the surface warfare community and the submarine community has been stripped off the, and now it's the ARG, it's the amphibs alone, so to speak.
I would argue that one of the things we should be thinking about is, at times, how do we form again, you know, for different types of operation or training, just putting those pieces together when the, you know, the CSG and the ARG are already forward deployed, and you create those task forces, task units with different elements included, is something just boggles my mind that we don't do now.
Well, I guess it also raises the question. I mean, as Sal pointed out, some of these new amphibious ships do kind of act as mini aircraft carriers, and if the Marines actually, if we ever see an F-35 with its short takeoff capability, how much? I mean, are they going to be even further removed from what, you know, the strike fleet?
That's a good question, and I think, you know, I think part of the answer is, why do we limit ourselves? You know, and maybe that's an easy way of saying we need to look at this in a little more holistic, you know, what naval forces bring and how you can create the combinations for each unique tactical situation that comes in front of you. How, you know, what are the tools there, and are we well practiced in putting them together?
In your article, you brought up a few names. You have Admiral Harvey. Obviously, he's retired and gone on to other things. Undersecretary Wirt, he's going to be leaving here pretty soon. Hughes and you know, Barney Rubble, they're both in academia, retired. Who on active duty right now, you know, because Wes Hammond can't do it all, who are the advocates? Who is out there in the marketplace of ideas putting forth the discussion, putting forth the argument, whether he's a Marine, whether he's a Navy guy or anybody else, to really try to drive this conversation as we go into an era of limited resources? We have to be very smart on how we allocate these things. who is making this argument, or are we kind of running on intellectual inertia?
Well, let me answer that two ways. From the Marine Corps side, you know, they just stood up about a year ago, the Ellis Group, out of McCitic. They work within headquarters of Marine Corps too. But essentially, you know, they're looking at how do we create what they call, single naval battle idea. Particularly looking at littorals, but not necessarily. The single naval battle being, you know, like I just alluded to, the idea of putting these tools together as you need them to operate in complex and difficult situations, but mostly naval. So they're supposed to have, and I think it just stood up, a Navy partner, and I heard the name the other day, but I can't remember what it was. So hopefully that's a piece of it, but it's not the only piece. And I think part of it is, you know, the one guy I really like that I lots of times go back to is Rear Admiral J.C. Wiley. And he's a very interesting figure. And many people, I'm surprised, don't know who he is. He was XO of a destroyer off of Guadalcanal that essentially he created off of Guadalcanal the rudiments of the initial CIC. And then he was tasked for Pacific Fleet to come up with the initial destroyer CIC handbook. He was a picket destroyer CO off of Okinawa, and then he and Admiral Burke went back to right before they were going to do Olympus and the landings in Japan, coming up with how do you create this, you know, how do you stop the kamikaze problem? So at tactical level, this guy has tremendous tactical bona fides. But I think the other thing is, you know, his book on military strategy, Colin Gray, who's probably, you know, one of the preeminent strategic theorists of today, calls it the finest work of strategic theory since Clausewitz's On War. So here you have a guy who's got just tremendous tactical bona fides, but also strategic. And if you look at his, when he looks, talks about control and comes up with the theory of it, he is very much into, you know, at the end of the day, it's the man, you know, the rifleman with a gun on the scene that really creates the, you know, the decisive factor in many cases. Wiley, I think, should be used more and more as a model to study, for a lot of reasons. And the other thing about Wiley, I found out by looking at him a little bit more, was he was best friends with Puller, or good friends with Puller. So he had a lot of cross-service experience, as well as, you know, both professionally and socially, that I think really helped add to his knowledge, as well as his thought train of thought.
We have a listener from Turkey who's in the chat room, and he's actually raised a pretty good question, which unfortunately didn't have to do with Admiral Wiley, but has a lot to do with balancing the fleet. And his question has to do with whether or not our main carriers, our CDNs, are they going to continue to be, as he said, pure blood carriers, or after the sequestration, or are they too going to kind of join the versatility of sort of sometimes supporting amphib ops and other stuff? How do you see that working?
Oh, I don't see anything in any near future of, you know, putting, you know, F-35Bs or MV-22s or anything like that on them. I just, you know, it would be hard to justify, you know, especially, let's just say that because of sequestration, you wanted to get rid of a capability. That's an expensive capability to keep on instead of something else, I would guess. But I don't think we're even going there, so I don't envision.
Well, I think one of the reasons it comes up is that during the tsunami operations, you know, we had a big carrier down there then, and it was doing basically what would have, you know, a lot of helo operations, and humanitarian stuff, and it, you know, it was a huge asset to have in the area. I just was curious if you saw any future for that and some of the other areas and aspects of amphibious operations.
I mean, I could see things like that for specific, small, particular operations. I guess if you had to think about what you were building the force for, it would be hard to justify how you would, you know, do, you know, that was how you balance your force.
I hit my mic in the wrong way. One of the things that's been the trend here is everybody's always looking for a written national strategy, and they talk about the, you know, Pacific pivot. It almost seems, because we really don't, I don't think at least, have a well-written and updated national strategy that you can use as a ref A. You know, we had some things published a few years ago, but a lot of it changed in the last few years. But you know, perhaps there's an unwritten national strategy. People talk about the Pacific pivot and things of that manner. But when you look at the fleet that we're building, you know, LPD-17 and everything else, it's designed and based on things in the past. When you look at a Pacific pivot, the ranges that are inherent in the Pacific, the types of allies and challenges that we're going to have there, combined with what through at least 2030 is going to be a very constrained shipbuilding budget. Are we really building the right mix of amphibious ships that we have? And in the course of redesigning the next amphibious ship, is there something that really should be looked at closely and emphasized that maybe perhaps isn't in the top three concerns that people have?
I think it kind of goes back to the point I was making and you brought up earlier was, a limited number of very capable platforms is something that I am concerned about. Numbers obviously mean something, especially when you're talking about the expanse of the Pacific and the number of hotspots potentials there. But I think also when you talk about, when you look at the A2AD problem, I think there's some, you know, obviously whatever it has to be capable of providing some sort of support to itself or be able to leverage other platforms for support. But you do get into what you referred to as all your eggs in one basket type problem.
Well, now it is the time for me to help close this out. So I really appreciate you coming on. What have you got in the works? What can we look for from you in the future? And when can we expect to see it?
Still debating what I want to talk about next. I'm not sure. There was a couple of hooks in that article that that could be used. One, I think I talked a little bit about Wiley. I think he would be an interesting person to use as a focus for, you know, just sort of the intellectual piece that brings the naval tribes maybe back together a little bit more. But I think the other piece is the idea of what other if you looked at future shipbuilding issues and platform issues, what are some of the trade-offs we can start, you know, at least throwing out for at least the debate on how you shape it? And I think, you know, that's a piece in there that I left kind of hanging at the end of that article.
Well, Wes, I really appreciate you taking time this Sunday for joining us. Have I enjoyed the hour and look forward to reading more of your stuff. And good luck for the rest of the year.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us live or getting us with the archive. Really appreciate it. Please join us again next week where our guest will be Dr. Joan Johnson-Free. She's a professor of National Security Affairs at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. Until then, hope y'all have a great week, and thank you very much. Have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Molly wrote on me to reply to Irish Paddy O, saying, Mike Maloney. pleasant friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.
Let those other guys make your family share data. Switch to T-Mobile now and get four lines with up to 6 gigs each of 4G LTE data. Just $30 a line and no sharing. So ditch your data worries and switch to the Un-carrier today. Get to T-Mobile or call 1-800-T-MOBILE.
Limited time offers plus taxes and fees. Capable device required. Coverage not available in some areas. See store for details.